Next case is 0741, Todd Development Company versus Sonny Morgan.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, Counsel, may it please the Court, I'd like to withhold 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Watch your time.
Thank you. This case presents a very narrow issue. It's almost a refreshing case from that standpoint, a very narrow issue of civil procedure. Does the movement and a motion for summary judgment bear the burden of addressing affirmative defenses in the initial filing? Or is negating an affirmative defense elevated to the level of proof of the movement's case as part of a motion for summary judgment? Although the issue is narrow, I think the context in which the issue arose in this case is very important to consider insofar as it illustrates the problems that we could have if, in fact, the rule advocated by Appellee is adopted. Secondly, I think the policy issue is extremely clear. Finally, only a strained reading of Celotex, Drescher versus Burt, and Civil Rule 56 will allow one to come to peace with Appellee's position and the rule they advocate. The context, of course, is the Court of Appeals agreed with us on all issues, except a minor driveway issue, and remanded the case for trial on the affirmative defense of laches only. And it's important to understand where laches appears and where it surely does not appear in the record in this case. This started when the developer sued the homeowners. They didn't bring the action. And in that case, the developer sought a declaratory judgment asking the court to conclude that the restrictive covenants were no longer valid as they pertained to a plat which had been replatted. That is to say, the developer owned part of some of the lots in the old plat and caused them to be part of a new plat. Importantly, the new plat had smaller lot size restrictions than the old plat. So they file a declaratory judgment complaint and sue all these homeowners, but nowhere in that complaint is the issue of laches raised. The essential point in that complaint where that suit is filed against my clients is these restrictions have no more validity. And of course, the trial court felt they did. The Court of Appeals agreed that those restrictions have validity. The homeowners file a counterclaim. Their counterclaim is essentially another request for declaratory judgment on the same issues. Again, asking the court to conclude that the covenants are viable. And in the answer to the counterclaim, the original plaintiff, the developer, pleads a laundry list of affirmative defenses. That list included laches.
And the rule requires them to set those forth or they're waived.
Use them or lose them, that's right. If they don't plead them, they will have waived them. And as we
so
all,
they're in.
So they are not waived defenses.
Okay, so they're in the case at that point.
Right, as affirmative defenses, which I think is an important distinction here. They file a motion for summary judgment. We file a motion for summary judgment. Their own motion for summary judgment does not raise laches. Our motion for summary judgment directed at their complaint saying, court, please dismiss this. Those are not, their claim that these are not enforceable is not valid, does not raise laches. The thinking being that's not an element of proof of their case and we are responding to their complaint. The memorandum in reply, both sides file, no mention of laches. The developer's pretrial statement, which required by the court and must set forth issues for trial, does not mention laches. So no one considers it, at least at that stage, legitimately a viable defense or defense.
Could you help us understand exactly what is present on the ground out there at the time this litigation is unfolding?
Well, that's a subject of dispute. But what there are, the ultimate issue comes down to lot sizes.
Understand.
And there indeed are homes built in a subdivision that is beyond the confines of the old plat. Many homes. Has nothing to do with that plat. I'm sure the people aren't happy that there's a bunch of new homes in their former beautiful view, but it's not in their plat. And the question of what is in their plat is a very difficult question insofar as we're talking about lot sizes, locations of lots, and lots for sale that have not been built upon. So any statement that suggests that there's rampant development there and they surely knew, or that there's a fact issue as to what they knew about what was occurring, is simply not the state of the record, and it's not the situation. This is not a big plat.
But that's what the Court of Appeals twice has said, it's going back to determine that.
Right, surely, and it's a strong issue for my clients if the case does go back to the trial court. But that is the issue. And the court reached that conclusion continuing an absence of pleading, an absence of much of a record concerning those problems. At some point in the set, what the developer files that they call a second motion for summary judgment and an objection to a proposed final judgment entry, mention is made of affirmative defenses. The criticism of the trial court that it has not addressed the affirmative defenses set forth in the answer to our complaint for declaratory judgment. Still, Latchey's not mentioned. An affidavit is filed at that time that says, well, we told all these people that we were going to have public hearings on this replatting. So to that extent, one may have an issue. But then you move further down. That's the first time.
In terms of what happened, I'm assuming this developer went to these people and tried to get them to sign off.
That's what he alleges, and he sued them because they didn't, because they were objecting.
Well, he went to them, asked them to sign off. They wouldn't. So he went on with the local authorities and got the plat changed with consent of the local authorities.
Question of the timing of all that is not clear in this record. Did he go to the local authorities and then come back after the fact to try to get permission? And when they wouldn't give it, did he sue them? I don't think there's anything in the record that suggests that these people got the legal notice of the effort to replat, particularly as it related to property that wasn't even their concern or anything within their control.
Did it even get that far with the summary judgment rulings here, as far as taking the evidence that you're talking about?
No, I don't. There's evidence. If Latchey's is in play, there's more discovery to do.
Okay.
Without question. Up through the Court of Appeals, they mentioned the affirmative defenses, but again, Latchey's is still not identified. And if you look carefully at the litany of defenses, their list of defenses pled like any defendant does so that they don't waive them includes failure to state a claim, estoppel, waiver, release, Latchey's, lack of consideration, statute of limitations, unclean hands, and acquiescence. If the rule advocated by Appellees is adopted, then the rule is that we have to somehow affirmatively demonstrate that we don't have unclean hands in filing a motion for summary judgment.
Yeah, Mr. Leppel, that's why I'm missing something here, but the proposition of law seems to go to the burden of the non-moving party, but isn't your contention, isn't the issue really what's required of the moving party?
Sure, and again, if you look at Celotex, if you look at Drescher, and the concurring opinion in Drescher indeed says, I don't want this to, Justice Pfeiffer's opinion, I don't want this to disrupt how we do summary judgment. So I only agree to the extent that it reverses the third syllabus of Wing, which simply seems to misstate something in relation to Civil Rule 56. So the question is, there's two things going on here. One is, if I'm defending against a plaintiff and I file a motion for summary judgment and it meets the four corners of plaintiff's complaint, then I've done what I have to do to shift that burden. But we're caught up in the fact that there's a counterclaim and there's an affirmative defense on a laundry list that raises Latchey's in response to the counterclaim. That's quite a different thing, and there's no authority. Of course, we have a split of appellate districts. Of course, the second district feels one way, and it's important to note that it was a panel of the second district that sat for the 12th district in this case because of conflicts, following their own rule back in the second district. But the 10th and Franklin County doesn't agree, the 3rd doesn't agree. Indiana Supreme Court does not agree.
So does the dispute come down to whether or not the trial court, whether or not what you filed was for summary judgment on your claim versus summary judgment on their claim?
I think that's one way to cast the argument, but I would make an even stronger argument. I don't think I have a duty. Let's assume that my complaint is all there was. Let's say the counterclaim's freestanding. I don't think I have a duty, and I don't think the case law, I don't think Drescher, I don't think the policy considerations of Rule 56 could ever support the idea that I have to go down their laundry list of affirmative defenses and negate them by affirmative evidence in my first filing. The policy is notice to parties of what are the issues. Our motion says we win. There's no dispute here. If they've got facts demonstrating laches or unclean hands or anything else, it's incumbent upon them to step up and reply to our motion with evidentiary materials consistent with what Rule 56 says. You cannot rest on your pleadings.
Does Drescher address this at all?
No, Drescher contains a long analysis of a very difficult coping with Celotex and how it would apply to this case, but absolutely does not address affirmative defenses.
But Drescher does set up this burden shifting. The movement has an obligation to demonstrate, if you will, prima facie evidence in order to sustain a judgment. No genuine issue of material fact,
right.
Entitlement to judgment as a matter of law.
Right.
And once done, the burden then shifts to the party against whom the motion's filed to rebut or to counter or to interpose some sort of a position to defeat the claim.
Including their affirmative defenses.
And so your view would be that this just falls, I mean, in one sense, right into the Drescher scenario. And once you have established what it is you need to show some breach of the platting agreement, then the burden would shift to another party to interpose a defense or some position to show a genuine issue of material fact or some question of law as to why judgment shouldn't be granted.
That's precisely their argument. And our appellate courts, whichever way they go here, they all point back to Drescher.
Yes.
So we're doing this because of Drescher. But Drescher is not about affirmative defenses.
But if you are suggesting that your position is in line with Drescher, what is it we can add in this case, if we would agree with you, that would clarify that? Is it just a statement about a movement has no obligation to disprove in a motion for summary judgment any and all affirmative defenses pled? Or does it go beyond that?
I think what all the lawyers of Ohio would like is a clear rule on this point, because we've got appellate districts going both ways. And the brightest line I can think of is, if it's an affirmative defense, you better plead it, you better provide evidentiary materials, because you're on notice, and you raise that affirmative defense. So we look at Drescher and we say, well, what we meant was when you're moving to dismiss a complaint, not when you're moving to negate affirmative defenses. There are other ways to get there, but I think that is the brightest line that would be most useful to litigants.
So does the rule then say that when a motion for summary judgment is filed against a party who has pled an affirmative defense, that party then has the burden to go forward and assert it or lose it?
That is the brightest line I think we could have, Your Honor. If there's no other questions, I'll save what's left of my time. Thank you,
Mr. Lepler. Ms. Matra.
Good morning, Chief Justice, Your Honors. I, Carrie Matry, and my partner, co-counsel James Matry, are here on behalf of Todd Development and HDC2, the developers of two separate parcels that became new subdivisions. The court had already asked, and I will answer, what was going on at the time that the developers felt the need to file a declaratory judgment action? Well, at that time, the year prior, lots were purchased, three on both sides of this L-shaped subdivision called Shaker Ridge. The preliminary plat had already been approved. It had already gone through the process of approval. The construction plat had already been approved, meaning engineers had been out to the properties, there had been survey stakes, people making determinations about where sewer taps were going and the roads and so forth. The next step is in January 2004. By that time, we have of record the final plat. At that time, all construction is finished. The roads are in, the sewers are in, utility easements are in, the lots have been drawn and decided, the survey stakes have been put into the ground.
Now, when you're referring to all of that, this is all outside the Shaker Ridge, or is this?
This would be not only behind every single one of the neighbors of Shaker Ridge, right, but also to both ends of Shaker Ridge, where the roads for ingress and egress off of the two main roads come in, off of Shaker Road and 122. So of the lots 1, 2, and 3 in this case, basically became a big road with easements and a cul-de-sac, and at the other end where there was already of plat an old easement for road ingress and egress, it was the second
so
entrance.
So with
in
this new subdivision, there's going to be, I think I saw in the briefs, two new accesses to the main highway.
That is correct, and it was
and
for safety purposes.
And the people who are already there are going to be rerouted out through the new access points.
The new subdivision homeowners would go only through those two new entrances, the two new roadways. The original 10 homeowners left in the new Shaker Ridge plat have that driveway easement, the one access point off of the highway.
So they can go?
Correct.
That way.
So the homeowners have always remained undisturbed. The issue became, what about those three plats on both sides now that this whole process has taken place? And we also have to consider, what is that process? Well, when the developers purchased these lots, these six lots, the lots were vacated. They were adjoined to larger acreage. Then there was the drawing of the new subdivisions and the new lot lines and the laying of the streets and so forth in the preliminary plat. The issue raised by our opponents was that, no, this is just a subdividing of larger lots that were intended for rural purposes to keep everything open and rural.
And so what did their summary judgment seek, and what was granted? What would be the impact upon the new lots that weren't in the Shaker division, and what would be the impact with respect to this road that's already in and open?
Well, that was one of the things that we raised, actually. This issue of latches was raised by us three times in three different motions, in our first motion for summary judgment, in our response to their motion for summary judgment, and in our second motion for summary judgment. In the homeowner's summary judgment, they basically asked the court to just conclude and declare that the restriction was a matter of record, and that the purpose of this no subdivision restriction was to keep the and maintain an open and rural character to these lots that they still own and still are exactly the same.
And they would still be 2-acre lots.
Right.
Yes.
And they always will. And we never asked that they be changed, ever. They also attached a test saying that the court should rely on this test called the substantial change or substantial radical change.
What I'm trying to get at is what's the practical effect? If this case wasn't here and you just had the Court of Appeals decision out there, what's the practical effect? And forget that they sent it back for determination of latches. What would be the on-the-ground effect?
In our response to that opposition, we submitted to the court that in order to give the relief sought by the homeowners, there would have to be a total deconstruction of the two new subdivisions. The roads would have to be removed. What about the sales of these lots to these now new homeowners that are already there?
Because there would be no way out?
Because those three lots on both ends were the way that they can get in and out of these subdivisions.
That's what I'm getting at. So the homes that are there would be landlocked?
Correct. Correct. Plus some deconstruction. Because what else would happen? And again, that was part of our latches argument. Again, this is again in the second time we brought it up in our motion. This is the second motion we're bringing up again. The homeowner's reply to that was basically, I think I'm quoting here, the defendants did not encourage them to undertake these actions, and they knew at all times that the restrictions covenant prohibited their activity. Well, I would submit that when you go through a process with the Warren County Commissioners and the Planning Commissions and the county engineers and the Water Department and MSD, and they all sign off on your plats telling you that this is the way you must construct, the developers then are bound to actually do that construction exactly as it shows on the plat. They cannot deviate.
On the legal issue before us, because we are not here to determine these facts, but on the legal issue before us, is it your position that the rule on summary judgment should be that the moving party also has to move on every one of the defenses that you raise?
I think when we're looking at the burden of the parties, I think the moving party does bear that initial burden to show the court through the evidence that is presented already within the court that there is no issue of material fact. And I think it also is clear that
not only as to their claim,
but to
as to any defenses, there's still no issue of fact. So they would have, if you had a laundry list of defenses as you raised here, they would have to go through and say, as to laches, X, as to unclean hands, Y, as to, and they would have to go through all of those affirmative defenses as well to get their summary judgment. That's the rule you propose or you believe this Court of Appeals has made.
As I read over the cases, Your Honor, I don't think the laundry list of affirmative defenses, I think the material affirmative defenses that would make a difference as to rendering judgment on the issue being proposed by the movement.
Who determines which are material defenses for these purposes?
Your Honor, that's that dichotomy.
Pardon?
That's the dichotomy I think Ohio lawyers are facing as to you would have to make, the attorneys are now left with making the decision as to what are the material affirmative defenses.
Well, to be safe, I guess, if we adopted your rule, the Court of Appeals rule, that the moving party would not try to decide which is material, which is not, but would have to put, to be safe, would present evidence on all of the defenses that someone had asserted.
That may be one way to resolve the problem that we face. However, in my mind, I kind of think of, if the question isn't asked, am I bound to answer? And I think that's where we get to the duty and the burden of the moving party. If you don't bring it forward, what is the corresponding duty of the person or the party that's responding as the non-moving party to that motion?
So they essentially have to prove their case and disprove your case at the same time is the rule that this decision proposes.
I think following what has happened in the Second District, which has been very clear, and I think I don't think that it does not act in accordance with the Drescher opinion. I think it makes sense because the Drescher opinion, too, says that you must look at the non-moving party's claims. There's language in Drescher that specifically says so. So it's not so much that you, and again, I think when you also look at Rule 56C and the laundry list there of what it you should look at when making your determination includes things like pleadings. And I think once we get to that and say, well, if you have to look at pleadings, what are pleadings? Well, generally, they're legal arguments, but there may be counterclaims, there may be cross-claims, and more importantly, there may be affirmative defenses, which Civil Rule 8C is very specific about what it is.
In the practical application of your argument, in this instance, a motion had been filed seeking summary judgment. Best stated position of your opponent would be, it's likely to be your burden then to raise the defense of laches in response to the motion for summary judgment, but you didn't do that.
Well,
and because you didn't, even though it was in your pleading, you lost it. And the court only had before it the matters that were raised in that motion. Why shouldn't we think about leaving the burdens with the parties who best know, as you say, which ones are relevant? Insufficiency of service of process, res judicata, laches, and let those parties raise their best issues for the court at the trial level to resolve.
Your Honor, according to my notes and my summary of that summary judgment posed by the homeowners, by the defending party, they asked on page 2 to conclude that the restrictions were there for, to maintain rural character. On page 5, that the test is for substantial change and included 2 affidavits. Other than that, pointed to no other point, no other argument of the record. All of the documents were already in the record. In the memorandum in opposition by the developers, the developers stated that the defendants were misapplying the law, was the wrong standard, that the language of the subdivision restriction was ambiguous and explained why, that the homeowners really just wanted free sewer and that's why we're here, and more importantly, on page 10, we did have our latches argument in response to that motion. Even though they did not raise it in their motion, we stated that in order to get the relief sought, there would have to be deconstruction of all of those infrastructures that have already been constructed. So we did, in fact, already raise the latches argument in our opposition to their memorandum and their summary judgment motion. Taking it a little bit further, and we look at, well, what are the court cases that are coming up in Ohio, it does appear that this court has already determined that Wing and Celotex went too far when putting an additional burden on the non-moving party and backed that off, and then restated it and said that when a party is moving for summary judgment, that it does have to consider the non-moving party's claims in order to obtain a full motion for summary judgment.
Counsel, isn't that in part due to the two prongs that are necessary for a moving party who wants summary judgment and to avoid a full-blown trial? You have to show the lack of genuine material issues of fact, but you also have to show entitlement to judgment as a matter of law, so that if the other side has already asserted an affirmative defense, it seems to me that you are looking at the entire case, and you have to address that to show your entitlement as a matter of law.
I would agree with you, Your Honor, completely. And I also would add that there's an additional burden on the trial court, that the trial court as well should not just look just to the motion itself, but is to consider all of the evidence and all of the pleadings before it.
Do any of our Supreme Court cases have to be adjusted to rule in your favor?
I was looking at Drescher, and Drescher seems to get there until we get to that word called material, which is such a difficult word for all of us. And I think that there is some adjustment needed as to what exactly is the burden. When is the question answered that the motion for summary judgment should be granted as a matter of law, that there are no questions of fact? And in order to do that, I think all Ohio attorneys are looking for a very clear, bright line as to what is it that I need to address. Again, when the Second District took a look at this case for us, it was clear that the homeowners in their motion never, ever discussed latches, ever. We raised it several times, and at only one time in one reply did we get a kind of a remark that, well, you should have known kind of response, which would be improper.
Is part of the problem here, and I guess we'll have to comb through the record. I have the sense that your argument is we put latches in, we pled it where we had to plead it as an affirmative defense. Then we file this motion for summary judgment. They file their motion for summary judgment. And in the course of that, we are arguing to the court, look, all of this happened. These people saw this. So that you're factually presenting, or at least in an argument, you're presenting the underlying facts of a latches argument without calling it latches.
That would be correct, Your Honor. We did not put the word latches into our argument, but we explained the effects of what would happen if the homeowners would be allowed to sit back, watch all this construction happen around them, never say a word, never file an injunction, never attend a hearing, although they claim that they didn't have notice.
Okay. But now, let's take that a step further in terms of just pure technical legal analysis. Do you agree that what you were in the trial court arguing about was their motion for summary directed at your complaint rather than their their complaint or their cross complaint?
That's hard to say, Your Honor. I mean, we filed a declaratory judgment action. We were just looking for the court to say, with regard to these separate.
Okay, but when you're there arguing before the judge, what are you talking about at that point?
I believe their argument was, doesn't matter what happened, what construction has happened, these lots were originally subject to this restriction, so therefore.
Their claim is their motion for summary was directed at your complaint rather than their complaint.
I believe it was, Your Honor.
All right. So now, if that's correct, you're there arguing about your complaint, their complaint where you set up latches isn't in play, but you make the latches argument in so many words without calling it latches. Can you drag that over?
Well, our motion for summary judgment was in response to their counterclaim. Their motion for summary judgment, I believe, was in response to our declaratory judgment action.
Your declaratory judgment action came after the construction was already complete?
Everything was finished.
As opposed to looking at the language in the subdivision restrictions and filing a declaratory judgment action before proceeding with the construction to avoid the sort of controversy that apparently did arise then?
Under our client's understanding and being developers, they were truly under the belief and believed they were acting with knowledge and lawfully when the plats went of record. The final plat was of record. As I said already, the construction's already done. That's a step before you get the final plat. So they were under no belief, since those lots had been vacated and joined to larger lots, acreage behind them.
Counsel, I was going to ask a question about the vacation and the replatting. It's referred to as these six lots were replatted. Mm-hmm. But before being replatted, there has to be a vacation from the initial plat that they were part of. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's through the Warren County Commission.
And that's my question.
Yes.
Was that done? It's kind of a two-step process that first you have to eradicate them or extricate them from the plat that they are included in, and then you want to include them in another plat. Is that the
sequence?
That's
correct, Your Honor.
And that happened here. There was the
yes, Your Honor.
Vacation, and then the so it wasn't just a one-step process for replatting. There was the actual vacation.
Yes, Your Honor.
Or vacating. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
I mean, I was not there, but yes, that's what I understand the process to be and how it is always done.
Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Metter.
Thank you.
Mr. Lepley, you've saved 2 minutes of your time.
So much of this discussion is way beyond the record. What is in the record is this drawing that was provided by Appalese, which shows vacant properties in this new proposed development area, no construction. We're getting to the facts, and that's not the issue, but nothing that would put anyone on notice, factually, to get to the underlying events here, that lots were proposed that were smaller than were required in the original subdivision.
What about the replatting or the vacation?
They can't vacate.
The other owners in the original plat notified of that?
No. And moreover, government can't come in and take away your protective covenants, your contractual rights, as the trial court held, as the Court of Appeals held, in agreement with us. All that's gone our way. All that's left is this question of latches, which brings us right back to where we really are today. What do we have to do? Do we have to go back and fight latches when essentially a rule of law proposed here is that you can lie in the bushes, not assert your affirmative defenses, material or otherwise, and how should I know what they consider material? And that I have to do something like file an affidavit that says we have complied with Civil Rule 19. We have clean hands. Do I have to go down their laundry list and affirmatively address those things? I think that that's not a good rule of law. I don't think that's what this court has said. And I think that's contrary to the modern use in the wake of Celotex, in the wake of Drescher, the Civil Rule 56. And I think when the appellate courts take it to that level, it's the very thing, the concurring opinion in Drescher feared. I'll concur in changing syllabus 3 because it suggests you don't have to negate the other guy's complaint in a motion. But let's not get into these other issues, because Civil Rule 56 works pretty well. It helps us get rid of cases that shouldn't be filed. It saves trials. And it did in this case. The rule of law, again proposed, will let them rest on their pleadings, precisely contrary to Civil Rule 56.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you
Leppler.
Very much.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.